Coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. It's been a year since former Delaware Attorney General Beau Biden lost his bout with brain cancer, but his legacy of protecting kids continues thanks to a foundation that successfully launched shortly after his death.
From that moment, we all knew, both myself and Beau's wife and brother and sister, we knew that Beau's legacy, his mission would continue.
We hear from Josh Alcorn from the Beau Biden Foundation for the Protection of Children about its work. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also examine the complicated process of forensic mental health evaluations and learn more about the hospitality school's efforts to help those struggling to find work. Plus, we make a game of this month's edition of History Matters. The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground, is next. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. Monday marks 1 year since former Delaware Attorney General Beau Biden died of brain cancer at age 46, leaving behind a wife and two children. His death rippled through the first state, drawing thousands of mourners and well-wishers to viewings at Legislative Hall and St. Anthony of Padua Church in Wilmington. The son of Vice President Joe Biden was known for his kind and compassionate demeanor and zealous drive to prosecute child predators and beef up laws protecting Delaware's youngest residents. Shortly after Biden's death, a group of those closest to him started the Beau Biden Foundation for the Protection of Children to continue his work. Delaware Public Media's James Dawson spoke with Josh Alcorn, Biden's former political director and now head of outreach at the foundation, about Beau Biden's legacy now and going forward.
Josh, how would you describe the past year since Beau has died?
It's been a whirlwind. Great thing about Delaware is that we have a Delaware Community Foundation that allowed us to go from an idea a couple of days after Beau died for a foundation that would bear his name, whose mission would be protecting kids, to an actual press release and a website and hundreds of thousands of dollars in donations pouring in basically 24 hours. From that moment, we all knew, both myself and Beau's wife and brother and sister, we knew that Beau's legacy, his mission would continue.
We saw thousands of people who attended one or more of his memorials over that week. Why do you think that Beau had that kind of connection with people? What was it about him?
Beau was the most compassionate person I've ever met in my life. When he talked with someone, he was talking with them as a person, as a fellow human being. He didn't look at people as, voters or supporters or constituents. They were people, and that's rare in elected officials around the country. I think Delaware maybe is a little more used to that with the kinds of people that we send to elected office, but he was unique amongst all of them.
Like you mentioned earlier, the Beau Biden Foundation for the Protection of Children came pretty shortly after he died. Obviously, it's a continuation of his work as Attorney General. But was this sort of an inevitable plan of his after he would leave politics, or is it something he maybe spoke about towards the end of his life?
My conversations with Beau year between when he decided he was going to run for governor, and his passing were all about, what he would do, mostly about what he would do in a campaign for 2016. We talked about 2016 all the time as it related to his gubernatorial campaign. So protecting kids was always going to be his focus, no matter what it was, protecting kids and the most vulnerable among us, right? Not just kids, but all sorts of folks. We never talked specifically about, would there be a Beau Biden Foundation after his time as governor? But we always talked about better ways to keep kids safe.
Since you mentioned that, what were some of the ideas that you two kicked around as to maybe how to better strengthen Delaware's laws as it relates to child abuse or things of that nature?
Well, I think the great thing about Delaware is, as a direct result of Beau's term as Attorney General, and people like Patty Daly Lewis, who's the executive director of the foundation, Delaware has incredibly strong laws as it relates to child protection. There's some tweaks that need to be made, And some of those have to do with, you know, mandatory reporting, who gets screened in, who gets screened out, you know, continuing to strengthen the cyberbullying and bullying laws as they exist in the state. So we're lucky that we have such strong child protection laws in the state. And, you know, Bo, something would pop up in the news about child protection, and he'd say, yeah, if this happened in Delaware, this wouldn't happen in Delaware because of the laws that we have.
One of the goals of the foundation is also to educate 18,000 adults on how to recognize and prevent child abuse. How is that going, and how quickly do you think you can accomplish that number?
It's going great. You know, the program that we're running in Delaware is called Stewards of Children. It comes from a foundation, a nonprofit based in Charleston, South Carolina. You know, there was a point in the investigation and prosecution of Earl Bradley that, you know, the Hannibal Lecter of child predators that we had in Lewis, Delaware, a pediatrician who molested and abused hundreds of his patients. There was a moment in that investigation where a woman came up to Bo on the street in Lewis and said, "What are you going to do about this? How are you going to make sure that it never happens again?" And I think at that moment, you know, Bo kind of thought, for the sake of the community, let's talk more about prevention. And so he asked Patty Daly Lewis, who at the time was the head of his family division, to find the best child sexual abuse prevention program in the country, and work to bring it to Delaware. And so she found the Stewards of Children program, and, you know, Bo stood up with a number of partners, including the Boys and Girls Clubs of Delaware, Prevent Child Abuse Delaware, the YMCA, and a host of others, and pledged to train 5% of Delaware's population. That's 35,000 adults in Stewards of Children, because one thing we know, and not just from Malcolm Gladwell and others, but if you can get 5% of the population trained and focused and thinking about one thing in one particular way, you can see a real cultural change. And so in the month of April, we trained about 400 people in Stewards of Children. Those were primarily kind of open trainings that we had at Delaware Law School in Newcastle County, at Del Tech in Kent and Sussex. We trained everyone from, you know, teachers and parents, you know, to law enforcement officials, to members of the Delaware National Guard, and we see our ability to continue this, to grow.
And one of the less talked about initiatives for the Bo Biden Foundation for the Protection of Children is a fellowship program to foster new leaders within the criminal justice system. Can you maybe talk more about that and explain what that's all about?
This initiative, this program is especially dear to my heart. The idea was, let's find a deputy attorney general or whatever they might be called in their particular state. Bring them down to Washington, D.C., give them an office at the National Association of AGs, give them access to some of our nonprofit partners, most specifically the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and help them figure out, you know, the best practices as it relates to child abuse, child sexual abuse and child protection matters in state houses across the country. Obviously, as I said, we have great laws in Delaware. But not every state is Delaware, and we believe Delaware should be a model. So let's bring somebody who's doing this every day in their lives down to D.C. to study the matter, and perhaps, potentially, hopefully, go back to their state houses with you know, a really good blueprint of how to strengthen the child protection laws in their state.
So what's the trajectory looking like for the foundation, maybe 5-10 years in the future?
I mean, I hope that in 5 or 10 years, we have eliminated child abuse in Delaware, that predators know that Delaware is not a place for them to come, because, you know, we talk about this, you know, invisible fence around the state of Delaware, where predators know that if they come here, they're going to get arrested and they're going to go to jail. You know, beyond that, we have, you know, a really great, incredible country, that we're a part of that needs to do a better job of taking care of its kids. And so, you know, our long-term goal is to, you know, be involved in all 50 states, running our programming, Stewards of Children, you know, our work with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children on in-school programming, talking to kids about keeping themselves safe online, both from, you know, predators and from, you know, peer bullies. And I think that all of our programs are portable in the sense that, you know, we can run them in Delaware and then we can move, continue them here, but move them to Pennsylvania and New Jersey and Maryland and then, you know, up the Northeast Corridor and west. So I think that our goal is to, you know, work as hard as we can to make sure the kids all over the country are safe, you know, once we've really firmly established ourselves in Delaware.
Our thanks to the Beau Biden Foundation for the Protection of Children's Josh Alcorn for his time this week on The Green. And The Green continues in a moment with a look at forensic mental health evaluations, a still imperfect process to determine if someone is competent and how they're still being refined. This is Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. You might have read the New York Times piece last month about Delawarean Toby Lopez, described in the first line of that piece as a, quote, supremely ordinary guy, unquote. He was a car salesman in Wyoming, Delaware, when, after a high school friend was killed in Afghanistan, began intense social media discussions with those who falsely claimed affiliation with the Islamic State terrorist organization. What started out as a few naive conversations turned into an obsessive flurry of communication that led him to quit his job, contact the FBI, and ultimately end up in jail, facing charges, and with his sanity in question. He went through multiple mental health evaluations before finally being released, based on a third evaluation done by Dr. Kirk Heilbrun, a Drexel psychologist that deemed Lopez mentally competent. While Lopez no longer faces charges, he says the incident and evaluations involved have left him with a tarnished reputation and difficulty finding work. In light of the case, Delaware Public Media's Megan Pauly talked to Dr. Heilbrun about the forensic mental health evaluation process, how it's been refined over the past 30 to 40 years, and a bias known as the allegiance effect.
Is there such a thing as a typical mental health evaluation?
Oh, gosh, that's a good question. Actually, if we're talking about forensic evaluations, I would draw a distinction between what psychologists and psychiatrists and other mental health professionals do routinely for diagnostic and treatment planning purposes, which is more your typical mental health evaluation. Draw a distinction between that and forensic evaluations, which are psychological, psychiatric evaluations done for the courts, basically, with the purpose of helping the judge use good information to make a better decision and to help a retaining attorney make a better case presentation if the information obtained in the evaluation is helpful to that particular attorney.
For the forensic mental health evaluations, is there a typical process that is normally followed?
Well, that is... I would not say that there's a real standard process because there are a range of evaluations that get done. Typically, they are divided according to what the legal question is. That's where you always start when you're doing one of these evaluations. So there are a range of legal questions that are criminal, civil, or family that forensic mental health professionals get involved in evaluating.
What all does a forensic mental health evaluation involve?
Well, there's some variability, as you might imagine, but typically they involve three things. One is direct contact with an interview and the chance to talk about various kinds of things. The second is testing. Now, psychological tests are given for different reasons. Some are educational, some are intellectual, some are symptom-based, some are brief screening measures, and there's a whole bunch of psychological tests that are out there. Most of them, for various reasons, aren't a very good fit for using in forensic evaluations. So we probably have between 10 and 20 tests that are that are pretty good fits. And when I say a good fit, I mean that typically a test like that there's been research on how it applies to that population, and it has been validated for that reasons. Then the third thing that you try to do as part of a forensic evaluation, and this is one way that it really differs from more standard mental health diagnostic and treatment planning evaluations, is you try to look at as many records as you can get your hands on and that might be relevant, and you try to contact third parties. So these collateral interviews are things that we use to try to inform us based on the accounts of people who are familiar with the litigant. Either they've lived with them, or they've worked with them, or they're friends with them, or they've been in contact with them fairly regularly in another way, and so we get their impressions. And so putting all three of those together, the interview and the testing and then the review of records and third-party interviews, is what really goes into a forensic evaluation, generally speaking. But sometimes a review of records or those collateral interviews might raise questions that you really would like to address again with the individual. And so you might see them a second or even a third time. And there's another advantage to doing that if it's feasible. And that is, if we see a person one time, then it's sort of one narrow slice of behavior and observations. The more you see them, the broader that kind of view becomes, and sort of the more stable and generalizable your impressions might be.
How is it determined when more than one evaluation might be required?
We work in an adversarial system. Our legal system is adversarial, as contrasted with the inquisitorial legal system in some other countries, particularly European countries. So in the adversarial system, what happens, of course, is that the defense usually gets the first opportunity to raise one of these issues, and if the defense raises it and gets an evaluation and the results come back as something that the defense might want to use in a hearing or a trial, then there's typically the opportunity for the other side to get a rebuttal evaluation, is what they're sometimes called. And so they might seek an evaluation from someone else in some ways to check and see whether the first evaluation is something that they should accept or whether it's something they should contest.
Are these evaluations ever misused?
Some of our research has shown that people do come back with somewhat different findings depending on who retained them. And that, of course, is a big problem. What you'd like, if you're the judge, is to be able to depend on the accuracy of evaluations, no matter which side they came from. And so we recognize within the field of forensic psychology and forensic psychiatry that the allegiance effect is a problem. And we take steps to try to handle that problem, to combat the effects of it, and so on. And some of those steps have to do with, first of all, recognizing that it is a potential influence. Secondly, getting as much information as you reasonably can. And then third, staying away from advocacy type of orientation and language and so on. It's an advocacy system, but the advocacy is promoted by the attorneys. And for mental health professionals, like forensic psychiatrists, forensic psychologists who are involved, their best stance ought to be, no matter who retained me, I'm going to do the best evaluation that I can. I'm going to show you the results, and I'm going to recognize that sometimes you might be pleased with those results. Other times, you're not going to be, and you won't be able to use them. But that's kind of your consideration and not ours.
Have you seen a fine line between sanity and insanity in certain cases?
There are a couple of considerations there. First of all, the frequency of defendants with behavioral health problems is fairly large, and it's growing, apparently. So if you look at people in jails and prisons and ask the question, what proportion of them experience something that you call a severe mental illness, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, other kinds of what we call psychotic disorders, then that percentage has been estimated through research as around 12%, 15%, and so on. That's a pretty substantial figure. If you look at all the people in this country that we have in jails and prisons, that's a lot of individuals with severe mental illness. But if you ask the question, how many of those, of that number, had been acquitted by reason of insanity, the number is much smaller. And there is, in some ways, a good reason for that, because just because someone has a severe mental illness does not mean that they also met the test for insanity, which in some states is, because of your symptoms, you don't know the wrongfulness of your behavior. And in other states, it's because of your symptoms, you either don't know that it's wrong or couldn't conform your conduct to the requirements of the law. So even someone with severe mental illness might not meet that test. In other words, their behavior, their criminal behavior, might have been motivated by things other than the symptoms of their severe mental illness.
Our thanks to Dr. Kirk Heilbrun for his time this week. Stay with us. We look at a program training those who face barriers to employment to find work in the culinary and hospitality industry. That's after the latest headlines on Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm Tom Byrne. There are a number of programs in the first state that try to help those who face barriers to employment, such as disabilities or a criminal record, find work. This week, contributor Larry Nagengast spotlights one of them, the Hospitality School. The four-year-old nonprofit, which runs out of the Holloway campus of the State Department of Health and Social Services south of Wilmington, is the brainchild of Rick Carter. Larry introduces us to Carter and some of the latest class of students at the Hospitality School in his piece, available right now at DelawarePublic.org. And he sat down with me earlier this week to talk about the program and the results it's producing.
Larry, who is the Hospitality School working with? How does it connect with its students?
The Hospitality School is a nonprofit program. It's on the Herman Holloway campus of what's the primarily the State Department of Health and Social Services down south of Wilmington on Route 13. But it's a private nonprofit organization that happens to be leasing space on the state property, and it's a program that teaches the basics of the restaurant industry, really, to young men and women who are pretty much down on their luck. They're primarily referred to the school through the State Division of Vocational Rehabilitation, which serves people who are having trouble finding employment or have special needs, physical handicaps, whatever. Also, they have a grant through the state's Criminal Justice Council, which means that they're providing a program also for former prison inmates and folks who are on work release and the like.
So tell us how it works a little bit. It seems in a lot of ways it's kind of a culinary boot camp of sorts.
Well, it is. It's a 14-week program, 11 weeks that are spent in the school and 3 weeks with internships at the conclusion. And in those first 11 weeks, the students are there from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., and they're essentially cooking in the morning, taking lessons, learning all sorts of different things about cooking, from whether it's a week making salads, a week learning breakfast, seafood, poultry. There's some time spent towards the end of the program on learning different international cuisines as well, Italian, Mediterranean, Mexican, the like. So it's a fairly broad an instructional model where you learn a little bit of everything, but you're also doing this in 11 weeks before the internship starts. So it prepares the students for entry-level jobs in the restaurant industry.
And it seems like it's been, over its 4 years, fairly effective, both from the numbers, what it's actually done in terms of placing people who are students there, and also in just hearing from some of the students that you talked to for this piece who seem to walk away with more than just those skills, but perhaps some other things that kind of helped empower them as they move forward with their lives.
Well, I think let's look at it quickly from the numbers. For over 4 years, they run four classes a year, 10 to 12 students per class. So you're in the neighborhood of 150 graduates thus far. 85% of them have gotten full-time jobs within the restaurant industry upon graduation. 80% of those have been able to keep those jobs for at least 1 year. So those are pretty good numbers right off the bat. In terms of talking with the participants in the program, I had a chance to interview four of the students in the class that is graduating this week. And it's easy to say from looking at all four of them that, yeah, they've come away with skills and, more importantly, a sense of confidence and self-esteem that they did not have before. A couple of these guys were prison inmates and served fairly lengthy terms, one for armed robbery, another one on drug charges. A couple others had been through schools that they didn't really relate to. One fellow was a Concord High graduate, another one went to Glasgow, and they just didn't really connect with their teachers at the high school level. And here in this culinary arts program, they found that the instruction was something that was more meaningful to them, and that they were able to learn better and really develop an appreciation, a sense of what they wanted to do going forward.
I guess in a lot of ways that seems to be the overarching mission of the man behind the program, Rick Carter. He seems to be someone who is looking for ways to, again, help people find work, but also kind of, as I said before, maybe empower them and give them something that they haven't been able to find elsewhere in other programs or in other schools, as you mentioned.
You're absolutely right. I mean, Carter tells me, you know, that his heart and his passion is helping youths who are at risk. And of course, this program, young men, young women, and some of them not quite so young people in this the current class are up in their 30s. One of them is 48 years old even. Carter started in the restaurant business when he was 13 years old, and you know, working at a donut shop or whatever. And he worked his way up and got himself into hotel management and food service business and the like, and you know, so he's learned a whole lot along the way, and at some point he kind of got tired of it and decided that he would maybe like to start a school. That didn't quite come about the first time around. Then he went off to try to get a degree in psychology, got his degree in psychology, and suddenly came to realize that he didn't want to sit at his desk and listen to other people's problems for 8 hours a day. And he went back to what he knew best. He revived his idea of the school, established it as a nonprofit, and reached out, secured several contracts with the state, and he's got what appears to be a very viable program right now, training folks who need training and who are really looking for a fresh start in life, and that's what's going on.
We're talking with contributor Larry Nagengast about his piece on the hospitality school. And it seems like this story, and Rick Carter's story in particular, and others like the late Matt Haley, that there's a sense that this food and culinary industry seems a little bit more likely to take chances on those who face some of these barriers to employment that you've been talking about, things like a criminal record. Any sense as to, you know, why that is, and you know, why so many in the field are willing to work with these graduates, or in the case of this program, host some interns for the program?
Well, I think part of it is that people who start in the restaurant industry and the hospitality industry and work their way up through it, they've had a chance to interact with people who have been down on their luck and who have not been particularly successful. But you can get into the hospitality industry and learn a lot of things. It's not necessarily dependent upon having the highest IQ in the world or having a great deal of book learning and the traditional skills. You can teach somebody how to cook and how to prepare food. And if you look at the industry and the type of work that's involved, you know, it's not like being a cashier in a retail store or an accountant or a bank teller or whatever, where you're dealing with money and there's a chance of theft and things going wrong of that nature. So a service industry like the restaurant industry, where your employees are working with food, it's a situation where you're less likely to commit a crime or be involved in a criminal activity that's going to have an impact on a large number of people in society. So they can be a little bit more forgiving in that respect.
The school, as we mentioned, has been around for 4 years. But it's not necessarily an easy thing to operate, and obviously it's not necessarily something that's cheap either.
Oh, no, it's not. I mean, Carter says it costs anywhere from $700,000 to $1 million a year to run the school and its programs. And a lot of that, of course, comes from the grants from the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation, Criminal Justice Council, and the like. But in addition to that, Carter has a business which is called Pineapple Catering, and it's a catering business like so many others that will handle events. It'll do weddings, parties for nonprofits and businesses and the like. And the revenue that Carter derives or derived from Pineapple Catering, to the extent that there are profits, that he plows back into the hospitality school, and that is a way of supplementing the costs of the program and making it more cost efficient to operate.
Is that not unlike what the Colonial School District of William Penn High School is doing with their culinary program, where the kids get to do some of these events and it kind of connects with what they're doing in the classroom?
Oh, absolutely. There is a connection. The students who are in the hospitality school have the opportunity occasionally to work part-time jobs with Pineapple Catering. And they've gone out and they've done events, for example, at Wilmington University, at the Wilmington Montessori School. And one of the things that that Carter tells me is that these students come back and they didn't realize that social events like this occur. It opens their eyes to a whole new world, seeing high society, as it were, for a night or two at a time. And they're so appreciative for having the opportunity to see how the other half lives. But the other piece of that, too, is that so many of these folks who are going through the program at the hospitality school come in there with very low self-esteem. They haven't had much success in life. And then they go out on a job and they're on a catering project, for instance, and somebody tells them, oh, this food tastes really great, or I really like the presentation and the way the dishes are set up. And it gives them a sense of pride and satisfaction that they hadn't received before in their life. And that builds, creates a spark and helps carry them forward.
And is there some opportunity for this program to expand?
Yes, there are opportunities for it to expand. Now, the basic culinary arts program, there's not much room for that to expand. 10 to 12 students is the ideal, and it's a 14-week program, so you really can't do much more than the four a year. However, they do run a separate program at the Ferris School for Boys during the regular school year. They do two groups of kids there. They are going to have a summer camp, and they are starting a co-op program in the fall for high school students, and I'm not exactly sure how that's going to work, but they are going to be bringing in high school students after school for a period of, I think it's going to run actually a couple of years. So you'll start like in 10th grade and work through 12th grade and learn the culinary arts industry over that extended period of time. So there are a lot of opportunities, possibilities there for this program to expand and for it to reach more people.
Thanks to contributor Larry Nagengast for joining us this week on The Green. Again, you can read his full piece on the hospitality school right now at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. Next up on The Green, we play some games with you in this month's History Matters. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green this week. I'm Tom Byrne. Board games are part of the fabric of our lives, and we're exploring their history this month on History Matters, produced in conjunction with the Delaware Historical Society. The Historical Society recently displayed several of its unique and even Delaware-centric board games as part of its new Untapped History series that seeks to attract new audiences by featuring less conventional items from its collection that might not otherwise see the light of day. Delaware Public Media's Megan Pauly sat down recently with the Delaware Historical Society's curator of images, Lee Reifenberg, to discuss her board game research, as well as Delaware's part in the story of the origin of Monopoly.
I'm Lee Reifenberg. I'm the curator of images at the Delaware Historical Society.
What are the earliest historical remnants of anything resembling board games?
Board games actually go back a lot further than we think. There were early versions of Parcheesi and backgammon, dice, and all sorts of other checkers, for instance, all being played by ancient cultures like the Mesopotamians, the Egyptians, and the Aztecs, among others. So it's a multi-billion dollar industry that we sort of think of in very modern terms today, but it has some very ancient roots.
So how do board games reflect different economic times throughout history?
We do call the board game industry sort of a recession-proof phenomenon, and a couple of great examples would be World War I, when times are bad and people are scared and they're very much remaining insular and at home with their family and friends. This is when we actually see the introduction of Parcheesi, and it became kind of an instant surprise hit with all ages, and so Parker Brothers really couldn't produce it fast enough. They couldn't keep it from flying off the shelves. A little bit later, during the Great Depression, we're seeing unemployment in the country hovering around 20% with really no relief in sight. But this is when Monopoly bursts on the scene. And so again, it's the hot ticket item between 1933 and 1935. And part of the reason for that is regardless of their situation, people can kind of compete against each other with fake money and the sky's the limit. So it represented a sort of form of escape that people really needed at the time.
Other than the economic piece, are there other trends in popular culture, other things throughout history that you see the board games reflecting, and just different styles or maybe even the way the board games are made?
In the 19th century, for instance, board games were very didactic. They were used as teaching tools. There were some very specific themes that you start to see, religion and living a moral and upstanding life, making good choices. We see that with a Sunday school-themed game that we have in the collection. If you were a kid in the 1850s, a type of game like this would have been very familiar to you, learning to make good choices, live a moral life. And so by our standards today, would it have been tons of fun to play? Probably not. But it certainly would have been preferable to learning tons of Bible verses or catechism or that sort of thing. So in that sense, it was certainly a good alternative. By the 1930s, we're really starting to see board games trending toward popular culture, especially in literature and film. So, we have a game based on The Three Musketeers that was released around 1930. And because, especially with books, these are characters that people already know and love, a board game based on those characters and themes is a way to sort of keep that relationship going. So by the time you see their faces printed on the box, you're really ready to go on the next adventure with them. So that's really fun. We also see it in film. For instance, when the movie Around the World in 80 Days came to theaters in 1956, a movie-themed board game followed soon after. And in this case, it's a super colorful game. It has photos of the cast and really visual elements that you recognize from the movie. So it's something that people can identify with really quickly.
Around how many board games does the Delaware Historical Society possess, and which ones have stood out to you?
We identified about 30 board games. We have others as well, card games and things like that, but 30 board games. A few that really stand out to me are, one is the oldest in the collection, which is called The Game of the Goose from about 1790. And the fun thing about that is, although we call it a board game, it's something of a misnomer because it isn't played on a board at all. It's actually a large piece of handkerchief linen. It's a dice game, and the squares are actually printed right on the material with the instructions in the center, so it's really very portable and something that would have been great in colonial times when its homes didn't have a lot of storage space. So it's a very practical leisure item. The other one that kind of sticks out in my mind is a World War II themed game called Tactics, something that's very much of its time, something that you might not, that you might appreciate from a historical perspective today, but that you would have really recognized if you were a child in 1940, when the war was very much a part of your daily reality. So it's the whole object of the game was to create winning battle strategies with these sort of war-related themes that you would have recognized instantly. So you would understand the vernacular and the visual elements because they were very much a part of your daily reality and worldview.
Tell me about some of the board games with a Delaware connection.
We have three Delaware-themed games in the collection. These games were initially produced as sort of fundraising novelties by local municipal organizations. One of them was called All About Delaware, which was produced by the Delaware Chamber of Commerce, and it's very sort of slick and professional looking, and it's a great introduction to the state for a player who might not be familiar. And it's one that's so well produced it would really stand up beside any mass marketed game on the shelf today. Some of them were a little bit more homespun. We have one in the collection called The Game of Historic Hohkessen. These would have been produced in very limited release, so they're rare today. We're lucky to have it. But it is definitely, you can tell that it was very much a homemade game. And there's value in that because it lists as many historic sites and homes and businesses as possible. And the fun thing about it is that those places are now sort of recorded for as part of the historical record in a very unique format. We also have New Arcopoly, which was created in the late 80s, early 90s, when the sort of themed Monopoly boards were all the rage. Newark was not the only town in Delaware to get in on that action. There are also Middletownopoly board games out there. We do not have any in the collection, but Newarkopoly is another really fun one that we have.
And doesn't the origin of Monopoly have a Delaware connection as well, the story behind Monopoly?
It absolutely does, and that's something that a lot of people really don't realize. There's something of a corporate fairy tale out there that a man named Charles Darrow was the sole inventor of Monopoly at the height of the Great Depression in the 1930s. That's not true. The real roots actually go back to 1904 when a woman named Elizabeth Maggie from Washington, D.C. took out a patent for the landlord's game. And Elizabeth was a Quaker. She was a passionate follower of an economist named Henry George and his single tax theories. And so she took it upon herself to market her game or test it out with the public by sending it to Arden, Delaware, which of course is a single tax community. It's very well known for that. And folks in Arden began to play the game, and it was popular to some extent, but folks found it a little bit boring. They found the sort of moralistic tone of the game to be a little bit of a drag. The whole point of Landlords was that it was railing against corruption and monopolies and land grabbing among the wealthy, so it was very suitable for the beliefs in a single tax community at the time. The folks in Arden, which it's traditionally a very creative community, went ahead and modified the game to suit themselves. They created their own versions, and those games are actually considered the precursor to Monopoly. When the people of Arden were sort of modifying the game, ironically what they ended up doing was creating a game that celebrated the very things that Elizabeth Maggie was trying to fight against, simply because it was more fun. So it did involve paying for property with fake money and what have you, and really the sad thing in Lizzie McGee's case was that she spent quite a lot of time peddling this game around. Parker Brothers rejected it for the same reasons that the folks in Arden were modifying it. It was boring, it was complicated, and it certainly wouldn't have sold well in the mass market. In fact, everyone who ever got a hold of the landlord's game to some extent modified it. And so that's why those versions are, eventually what it said is that those versions made their way into Charles Darrow's hands. It's believed by game historians that he was introduced to some of these modified versions by a friend. And so that's how they ended up in his hands. So it's, but it does sort of blow a hole in the story that he could have ever been the sole inventor, because the similarities are uncanny.
Our thanks to the Delaware Historical Society's curator of images, Lee Reifenberg, for her time on The Green this week. And you can visit our website at delawarepublic.org to see images of games from the Delaware Historical Society's collection. And again, the Delaware Historical Society's look into board games is part of its new Untapped History series. In July, that series will explore the history of nightlife in the First State and beyond. And that's a wrap on this week's edition of The Green. Remember, the stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website and on iTunes. We also want to hear from you. Give us your feedback and story ideas on our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible. Contributor Larry Nagengest, Delaware Public Media's James Dawson and Megan Pauley, as well as our president and station manager, Casey House. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us and enjoy your Memorial Day weekend. We'll see you next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.